I will call the meeting to order.
My understanding is so.
Would somebody like to move the minutes from March 13th?
So moved.
Representative Fritz moves the minutes. Any discussion? I don't see any, so all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Approved. Approved, I'm supposed to say. The motion is adopted. First on the agenda is House File 892, Representative Mellon. And I would move we'll move the bill, and eventually it will go to the General Register, but we'll do that motion later. So, Representative
Mellon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're here with House File 892. And this bill improves the international recognition and enforcement of Minnesota child support orders. And I'm going to have Judge Lansing explain a little bit more about the bill, but I just wanted to explain to the committee why we're here today. This bill was before the Judiciary Committee last session, and the motion before that committee was to send it straight to the General Register. During the hearing, DHS thought that perhaps there would be a fiscal cost, so we changed the motion to send it to this committee to explore the potential fiscal cost. And if you look at the fiscal note, there of course is all zeros that there won't be a fiscal cost, but there's some conjecture that if this, then that. And so basically DHS is saying they don't know when they could incur a cost. It kind of depends on some federal legislation. But if this is enacted and the federal legislation is enacted, then there's a potential fiscal cost in the future to DHS of about $49,600, which would be incurred to update their computer system to in order to enact this legislation. So I just wanted to let the committee know that that's why we're here. Your fiscal note says there's no cost, except if you do look on page 3, of 7 of the fiscal note, it does talk about potentially in the future there'd be a cost of less than $50,000 in order to implement this, but that is contingent on whether or not the federal government acts as well. So, that being said, on why we're here, I'm going to have Judge Lansing explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Judge Lansing.
Thank you very much, Chairman Huntley. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Harriet Lansing. I'm president of the Uniform Law Commission. As has been said, I am here this morning on behalf of the ULC and as a commissioner from Minnesota in support of House File 892, the revisions to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. I will be brief. I know that you have a full calendar and also that you have a summary sheet for the act. Essentially, it extends and strengthens our international recognition and enforcement of Minnesota child support orders and coordinates with the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support. The act preserves Minnesota's authority over child support issues. We have very effective, as you know, child support legislation drawing on years of uniform law in this area. The necessary changes have been worked through to allow this protective measure to function internationally. The Minnesota State Bar Association and the American Bar Association endorsed the act, and the delayed effect is for the purpose of aligning with the effective date with the federal legislation. The federal act was introduced this session by Senator Baucus on December 19th, read twice, referred to the Committee on Finance, and Senator Baucus has now appended it to Senate File 1870, which is an act supporting at-risk children. He filed a written report on February 6th, so it appears to be moving along, and we're anticipating further action.
Okay, any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to confirm all foreign countries use tribunals in regards to this. That's why we're deleting the one section, replacing references to tribunals everywhere.
Judge Lansing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, that is correct, that we use the treaty language for those purposes, and so that's the generic term that they were able to come up with that would apply equally to all.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Moline, do you have any final comment?
No, Your Honor. I just would ask for the committee's support and to get this to the General Register.
Okay, and I've been called a lot of things in my life, but Your Honor has never been called before.
Did I just call you Your Honor?
I'm
sorry. Well, I think you're honorable, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Okay, so I would move that House File 892 be re-referred to the General Register. Any discussion on that? I don't see any, so all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Motion prevails. 2408 Newton.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2408.
We have the House File 2408 has been moved. It's going to ultimately be laid over, but we'll do that later. And we're going to allow about 20 minutes of time on this one. So, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I heard the word max thrown in there. House File 2408 provides a 5% rate increase for home and community-based services and for older adults and people with disabilities. Most of the members of this committee have either heard this bill in Health and Human Services or they've been lobbied and heard this bill before. It's just almost identical to what we had last year in House File 777. So I won't go through the four pages of cliff notes that Bruce Nelson gave me. But what I'd like to do is turn over to our testifiers so they get a chance to talk in our 20 minutes, Lucy. With me today I have Steve Larson, who's Senior Policy Director for the ARC of Minnesota, and Steve Pikarski, who's the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services. They are the co-chairs of the 5% campaign. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota and co-chair of the 5% campaign. And I just want to ask you to reflect on the testimony that you heard so far. Mr. Kurt Rutzen was able to testify on the governor's supplemental budget, and I think he spoke much more eloquently than I can in regards to the 5%. The ARC Minnesota is an advocacy organization, so we do not benefit directly from the 5% campaign. But our members do, because they're the part of the 90,000 individuals that are living in the community and depending on the support of direct support staff to meet all of their needs. And so I'm here today excited to be co-chair of the 5% campaign, not the 4% campaign, but the 5% campaign. And hopefully we will continue to move forward in this legislative session. And I want to thank you for your strong support so far, Mr. Chair. And committee members.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, my name is Steve Pikarski and I'm the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, and I'm also a co-chair of the 5% campaign. Today I'm here to support House File 2408 and the critical need for a 5% increase to community-based services that support adults, older adults, and their families. House File 2408 impacts 25,000 older adults who receive assistance and the 90,000 caregivers that provide quality care in order to help older adults remain in their homes and communities for as long as possible. Community-based services for older adults are a broad array of services that help them to continue to live a healthy and independent life in whatever place they call home, whether that be an apartment, an assisted living, their own home, or living with a family member. A few of the ways older adults could receive services are through the senior nutrition program, which are home-delivered meals or congregate meals at sites, senior companion services, which is a stipended older adult volunteer who takes them to doctor's appointments, grocery shopping, or just socialize with the older adult, or by caregiver respite so that their family members can get a break, a much-needed break. This critical care needs to be provided by consistent and trusted staff. Addressing turnover and wages will help maintain the workforce with the capacity in both size and ability to meet the needs of older adults in the future. As Minnesota's demographics continue to change, age trends will transform our state. The demographic transformation will increase the need for quality, community-based supports, and the 5% rate increase will help ensure that life in the community remains the first and best option for older adults. It is estimated that the use of community-based services instead of institutions saves approximately $31,900 per year. Even with good planning for retirement, two-thirds of older adults still need some form of assistance to go about their daily lives. Community-based providers represent a critical area where capacity needs to be maintained and expanded in the short term to meet the demographic need, and by doing so will save significant public dollars in the future. When older adults have community-based services to help them remain active members of their community, they age well at home longer. The 5% is a commitment to quality of care that begins to close the gap on the near decade of funding reductions placed on the backs of those who provide care to our most vulnerable populations. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Let's go on to Chris Gribbsbach.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Can you hear me okay? My name is Chris Krebsbach. I am a Vice President of Operations with Tealwood Senior Living. And we're a member of the 5% Coalition asking for increases to waiver programs that serve the people who are elderly and people who are disabled. Tealwood Senior Living specifically serves about 25 assisted living communities throughout Minnesota, about 1,349 of those are tenants in those communities. In that population, I would say about 380 of those people are elderly waiver people. So that is about 29% of our total population is the elderly waiver population. To give you a little bit of my own background, to get off of the two pages, I've spent basically my adult life as a caregiver. I was a personal care assistant for about 9 or 10 years while I was trying to figure out what to do with myself, and then became lucky enough to become an administrator. And as I became an administrator, I loved it, and it loved me, and it was a great job and profession, where I've been lucky enough to serve assisted living and nursing homes and work with many, many great people on many, many different levels. That journey has taken me to assisted livings, where I now work with assisted livings solely, which has been a blessing. Even more than that, on a very personal note, I have a grandmother who's 92 years old who has elderly waiver and is in the elderly waiver program in the St. Cloud area. And as a 92-year-old female and being a lifer in the business, I can tell you that, you know, I thought I knew a lot about it, and then when I sat at her kitchen table and had seen her get assessed, I saw for myself what really the needs are. Can you comb your hair? Can you brush your teeth? Can you manage your meds? She had 44 medications she was taking on a daily basis that she rolled out in a bin, which I had no clue. And so these are all people, my grandmother and others, that are in apartments and in community, and she's lucky if now where she's in an assisted living where she can be a part of this elderly waiver program. But this funding is key to being able to keep people in their homes and being able to keep them in a setting that looks and feels and seems like a home, because nursing homes, as we all know, is a whole another ball of wax. So with that, I wanted to give you a little bit more of my background and why I think it's important that we're able to And I get the fact that we've got a 1% increase in April, which I'm very appreciative for, and it's great. However, on top of the 15% reductions that we've had over the course of the last few years, you know, it's helpful. But we're asking for a 5% increase to help us to be able to close the gap so that we can pay our staff, so that we can provide home-like alternatives and keep people in settings that they want to be in. So thank you for your time.
Any questions? Don't see any. Let's go on. Is this Paula Hart?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning and urge your support for House File 2408 and our campaign for 5%. My name is Paula Hart, and I'm President and CEO of Volunteers of America. We are celebrating our 118th anniversary this spring for providing services to Minnesotans. The 5% campaign would directly improve the lives of thousands of people with disabilities and older adults, including hundreds of people served every day by Volunteers of America, who depend upon the home and community-based funding, which is in both our special needs and our seniors programs. Specific to older adults, the participants in a number of our services directly benefit from the elderly waiver each day. Between our Park Elder Center, which serves Hmong elders in a culturally relevant way, and the Southwest Senior Center in Minneapolis, we supply structured programs to more than 75 older adults, starting at age 50, which I think is a very young older adult, up to age 96, and we provide dignity, hope, and an independent quality of life to them. You're hearing a lot of numbers this morning. Chris shared the story of his grandmother. I'd like to tell you about another person behind all of those numbers. His name is Jack, and he operated a truck on the Iron Range before a stroke robbed him of both his home and his job. He moved to Minneapolis, where the social worker, Linda Walker, at the Southwest Senior Center, who I think is part miracle worker, helped Jack find housing and also signed him up for the Adult Day program through the Elderly Waiver. Thanks to that program, Jack receives regular health monitoring, socialization, nutrition, health services, exercise, one-to-one counseling, and is part of a community that is really meaningful to him. The Elderly Waiver saves Minnesota $275 million a year and helps older adults like Jack access this kind of home and community-based support to live in the most independent setting possible. Beyond our adult day services at Volunteers of America, we provide assisted living services funded by the Elderly Waiver. We help more than 100 older adults and people with disabilities every month with an average age of 85 who live in subsidized housing in Minneapolis and the surrounding areas. 98% of that funding comes from the Elderly Waiver and the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, or CADI Waiver. Our assisted living programs minimize nursing home placement and reduce clinic visits by providing home health services, homemaking services, and meals to the people we serve. Some of those additional services include medication administration and management with people like Chris's grandmother, who often have very many medications on a daily basis. We also provide delegated nursing services, supervision, and daily wellness checks. The Elderly Waiver is the only funding source available to those people to fund their home health services. At Volunteers of America, we're also part of the Long-Term Care Imperative, a collaboration of providers that works to promote personal choice and dignity in older adult services. And today I'm here on behalf of this group also to urge you to help preserve Minnesota's superlative long-term care services by approving this measure. So thank you in advance for your support for this 5% rate increase.
Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And we have Jody Fisher and Kim McGinnis.
Good over here.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Jordy Fisher, 29 years ago, this month, my life changed in a second. I was 17 years old, and I hit a patch of black ice. From that moment on, I would not survive without assistance. I know how hard it is to work in this job. I see it daily. I also see how care has made a decline in age year as speeches
get further
behind. We have really awesome workers who have to leave to me for it's Mayo or Costco, and I am trying to be the voice of thousands of others who also need them. I used to be I used to be like you. And driving home this afternoon, God forbid, you might end up like two. Like me, please, for a little 5% raise. My name is Jordy Fisher. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you today. We need 5%.
Thank you for your testimony. questions? See any? So thank you for your testimony. Oh, right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you for your testimony, sir. And one of the things that I heard loud and clear from what you said is that this could be any of us at any time. And we did some meetings this summer where we talked about healthcare costs, and one of the presenters showed some data that shows that 85% of the population is going to need services at some point in time, and we will find ourselves needing services for either for a disability that we don't have today, or because we are going to be aging. And so this is certainly an issue that is going to impact every single one of us in our lives at some point, if it's not today. So thanks for making that point, sir.
Okay, move on to Kim McGinnis.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kim McGinnis. I've been a caregiver at my current group home for 15 years. I'm a direct service support staff for people with developmental disabilities. I'm full-time and have a college degree. I get different wages depending on which shift I'm working, and the most I make is $10.22 an hour. That's the high wage for my house. And I've been in this field for 19 years. My company tries a lot of different methods to get people to apply for jobs at our homes, but the problem is that they don't stay. It's very demanding work for low pay. We perform medical and basic living cares. We do the cooking, cleaning, shopping, transportation, laundry. We manage programs on skill development, arrange community outings. We have to document our clients' daily lives and health status and take responsibility for any mistakes made. There are other risks to consider sometimes. For example, I've been physically assaulted many times at my job. It can be exhausting work, especially when we're understaffed, and my coworkers all have second jobs that they work to help pay the bills. I put in 40 hours a week at my home and work another 15 to 25 a week at a second caregiving job. This turnover rate that we have is very hard on our clients. When I have this discussion with people, I ask them to imagine becoming disabled and needing help with bathing, toileting, dressing, and medical treatments, very invasive cares, and their caregivers constantly being replaced by inexperienced strangers. That's what happens in our homes when our staff aren't appropriately compensated. Our clients are very vulnerable, and it's incredibly important for them to have someone who they know and trust. Their best qualities and skills are just greatly enhanced in a stable environment, but I think that our funding gives people the idea that our work and our clients aren't that important. The first clients I worked with at a group home didn't have families, and they had a very hard time making friends, and their caregivers were the only friends and family they had, but inevitably, we all moved on to higher paying jobs. I'm just going to talk a little about this because sorry, it's just I've made the decision to leave my job and work in a different field. It's just that I'm here. I'm sorry. It's upsetting because I've been with my clients for a long time, and I love them, and I know that they trust me and want me to stay, but it's gotten too hard. A couple months ago, we were really struggling to get staff at our house. We had no supervisor, no program director. We didn't have enough basic support staff. All our staff were totally exhausted. And I remember telling, I was working after hours at my other job also for the same reason. So I was working almost 80 hours a week, and I told one of my coworkers that I was worried I was going to make a medication error because I was too tired to focus. And sure enough, a couple days later, I made a pretty serious med error. So that's basically all I'm going to be able to say, I guess. I just want to add that. Our our clients have really fantastic quality and potentials. And it's really hard to see them undermined by instability in their homes. And I hope you keep that in mind when you make your decision. Thanks very much for listening to me and everyone else today. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Oh, to the bill.
Well, I'll go now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah, are we through with witnesses?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to wait for that. So, and thank you, Ms. McInnes, and for your dedication to your work. And Mr. Chair, you are well aware of all this, and all of us are just compelled by the dedication of staff and the commitment they get to their clients. And the challenges that we face is there's turnovers here. And so I don't think there's any argument about that these individuals certainly need the raise, and we wish we could do this. This is the Finance Committee, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to talk about where we are. And the problem with this target we have is not in this room. It's outside this room for some reasons. And just to tell people that yesterday was adopted a target of $75 million for this whole committee. This bill costs $80 million, and so you can see right off the bat that it's not going to be fully funded, which disturbs me. And I'm not trying to be clever. I'm just really disappointed. We could have done some reforms yet this year, and we didn't do those to find some money. And we've not asked individuals to streamline programming or innovate or find clever ways to serve people in new and better ways like we've done in the past. And so we're stuck with our target just on raw dollars. And the governor suggested we would spend, 18, $19 million on other things, and so those are going to be competing for that $75 million. And so I would suggest to people who care about this that they make sure that they talk to the governor, who only offered a four, and the leadership in this House, who has made a decision that the most they can do is four. And this is my third comment about it in 24 hours, and I really didn't want to be that guy, but 16 years I've been here watching these challenges. I didn't have time to add up the changes, pluses and minuses. But this group has lagged behind nursing home wages. Nursing homes have been more protected from some of the reductions over the years for all kinds of reasons. but not based upon the deserving nature of the employees who work there. And I've just been so impressed with just like the woman who was here and the plight of the man who spoke ahead of that. And so if we really mean to do this, then we should. And I think this is the time. And whether you disagree or not with the source of the money that's on the bottom line, it's sitting there. And it's not my decision. I only get one vote, and I'm in the minority, and I don't get to set the targets. I just get to cheerlead. And I'm not even pushing my good friend, the chair, on this. I'm just trying to help him get a better target that can do what he in his heart would like to do. And maybe he wishes he was giving this speech. I'm not going to speak for him on behalf of that. But I'll tell you, if we don't look after these individuals who are serving in these direct service positions, we are going to have a system that will collapse on us, especially as the minimum wage bill goes forward and you get pressure from Walmart and other, and a lot of them are above minimum wage anyway. But as those become the jobs, then no one's going to want to do this except to be deeply caring. And we put the system in peril. Minnesota is leading the country in some of our concern and some of our quality of services. And it's up to us at this table to design programs and balance a budget based upon that within parameters set up by some leadership corner somewhere. And I don't know who decided that, but that's still fungible. It can be changed. And I would urge members of the audience and this table to remind the leadership of this place what's important to us. I don't know what the Senate target will be. And there's all kinds of funny House and Senate politics going on, and this is not about politics. This is about properly caring for the individuals who are in our charge. This fellow who was there before, I didn't remember his name, didn't plan to get this way. It just worked out. I had a serious snowmobile accident 10 days ago. I could have been that guy. And it got my attention again. And so, so I'm happy I, but just for the grace of God, you know. And so, as people who care about our fellow man and the grace of God, it's our duty to look after these individuals in a good way. So, Mr. Chair, I won't go on, but I'm just troubled, and I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abler. We have, we're already over time, but we have three people on the list here. If they could keep it brief, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just wanted to make sure, because I couldn't quite hear the hourly amount that Kim is making after 19 years.
I believe,
can you repeat that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz, I believe it was $10.33.
Okay, $10.33.
22 cents now.
22 cents. $10.22, and you've been there 19 years. 15 at that home. Okay. This, you know, we hear this all the time, and this isn't a crisis. This hasn't been in a crisis for the 10 years that I've been here. So, in my district, they're making $7.36 an hour in some of these group homes. So I just wanted to get the numbers out there and thank everybody for their great testimony, and thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, and I have an announcement. We have a group from the Convent of the Visitation in Mendota. It's the 12th graders. Welcome to the committee. And Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just had really raised my hand when she was speaking because it was such moving testimony, and I wanted to thank her also for the work she does and for coming here and sharing with us. And all of us on this committee see throughout every year that we sit on this committee that the numbers on a spreadsheet are not just numbers, that it's real people. And not only real people who need real services, but real people who are delivering those services and want to and do their best and put their heart and soul into it and deserve to be able to live and support their families at the same time. So I think this is really brought home today. But then after Representative Abler's comments, you know, I just want to say that even though I know Representative Abler is not couching it in political terms, the nature of it is political. And we've got one party, many members, not all, we know, but many members are saying, give it back, give it back. The members on this committee would like a larger share of the money that is available to go to these really important services. But there are, as we know, Health and Human Services is not the only arena in which we're playing here. And as long as, you know, it's for one side, for the other side of the aisle, for many of the members, it doesn't seem to matter how much tax cutting we're doing. We should do more, and we should do it until the money is all gone. So let me just put that out there. I know Representative Abler is not one of those people. On the other hand, you know, you had a really even more difficult target when you were the chair of this committee, and you know, I think what we got was certainly, you know, was in that budget was a cut to this group of people that we were able to buy back. So, and I know we've gone back and forth on this, Representative Abler, but you know, we're all trying to do our best with the cards that we are dealt, and I know that Representative Huntley is a very good advocate for the budget of this committee, and he works hard at that. And unfortunately, you know, if we had a bunch of GOP members who were also saying, hey, let's spend more money on people who need services, maybe we could really get somewhere. Let's have a bipartisan effort, not just in this committee, but to leadership, to say we won't bash you on the floor for not cutting enough taxes. Let's encourage you to not cut so much taxes and use the money for some of these folks that need to earn more to provide these services. That would be great.
Remember, we have only 45 minutes, and we've got three more bills to go. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, and to Representative Liebling. I'm going to exercise what my mom always taught me, which is to increase the distance between stimulus and response. So I'm going to do that for just a little bit. It's always a healthy and good thing to do. But first of all, just to the advocates out there, Representative Abler yesterday had a very interesting decision to make whether or not he would try to, in ways and means, actually give you 5%. because he had an amendment that actually funded this at 5%. And all the buttons that I read say 5%. And the testimony that we heard in the committee was, well, 5 is really kind of an idea. And it's kind of a movement, and we're moving in that direction, and it's not an actual number, but it's more of a trend or a trying kind of a thing. Actually, sometimes words mean things and numbers mean things, and sometimes numbers mean things, and they particularly mean a lot to people who are relying on that increase to pay their bills. I visited a group home in my district where they had a very limited number of clients, very limited number of people helping them, and they can't have people stay behind. They have to take everybody to the mall, even if somebody's sick. They can't do this. They're having to either everybody stay home or everybody go out because they're short-handed. I had a group of people in my office that were trying to make ends meet, helping people out, doing back-breaking work, doing really hard physical work for $10 an hour or less. And I said, how many of you have second jobs? And I felt like an idiot because they all started laughing because, of course, they all have second jobs. Every single one of them had at least one other job. So to the extent that that we can, I think it is about priorities. And if it's 5%, then it's 5%. Let's fund it at 5%. Let's be honest with people. We're making priority decisions on the governor's budget right here. We have committee targets that we are making priority decisions over. If we can't fund it at 5%, let's at least have the honesty to say we don't have enough money or we decided to spend the money somewhere else. So to the advocates out there, I apologize for this, and I hope that you recognize Representative Abler's attempts to do that, and we will continue to do that as this moves forward. Thank you.
And the last speaker or question is Zerwas. We're going to have to move ahead.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I'll be brief, and I think this was mentioned a little bit. Certainly, Representative Fritz brought it up in the idea that there is, especially as you get into greater Minnesota, there is a large swath of individuals that work in these direct care, direct service positions that are making, in many instances, below $9.50 an hour, and in many instances, just around that number. And it's clear, as you look at what priorities are and where this legislature is moving, that you know, it's almost a foregone conclusion that we're going to end up with a raise in the minimum wage, and a raise that will put significant pressure on these care providers and on these organizations. And my fear is, as we move for that $9.50 an hour minimum wage, certainly in greater Minnesota, where these rates are already lower than in metro areas, and then we penalize them by not giving them a 5% increase. I don't know how a lot of these service providers are going to go shuttered, how they're going to operate, let alone recruit and retain, when you have the option of working overnight in just grueling work, or stocking the shelves at a Walmart or a Target. So clearly there's an issue, clearly there's a disconnect, and I agree that the chair is not the one we should be putting pressure on here. It's the governor's budget that was a disappointment, it was House leadership's targets that were a disappointment, and I would encourage folks, I get the letters, I get the visits, but direct your letters and your visits to the few people in this city that can change it, and the few people in this city that can make 5 mean 5. Because Representative Dean is right. 4 isn't 5, and what'll end up being 3.6 isn't 5. 5 is 5. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, and Representative Quam, if you could really be brief.
The chair of this committee, no matter when, is required to take a few fish and a few loaves and feed many. It's never seems to be enough. Again, on this bill, some of this money could go to retention and recruiting, And frankly, the rate should be having an uplift factor for the quality that's added, where you've got more experienced personnel, so we can take care of retaining the people. And I suggested on other bills, and I think that we should look at that approach for this, so that if you retain your staff and more experienced, that you get an uplift on the rate to be able to keep them, and then you cut down on what you're spending, and more of this 5%, 4%, whatever it is, and the bill can go towards recruiting and retention, and I'd rather have it go to paying the people that are hanging around and caring and giving.
Representative Newton, any final comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Lacking the eloquence of my good friend Jim Abler, I think that he hit this right on the head, is that we in our respective caucuses need to go to our leadership and work on coming up with the additional $20 million that this is going to cost. And I would suggest also that Bruce Nelson and both Steve's perhaps get the Kims and Jody's of the world over to the governor's mansion. That seemed to work very well on medical marijuana. And he's in a body cast right now, so you've got an attentive audience. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to move House File 2408.
Well, we're going to lay it over for a possible inclusion.
Thank you.
The bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newton. Next, we're going to Representative Allen, House File 2458.
Just change the heading on that. That would be my.
And again, testifiers, we're really short on time.
Well, they're going to come over tomorrow.
So, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill modifies the requirements related to approval of education and training programs as work activities under the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And I have the advocate here, Catherine Wagner from Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And I'll just briefly state that what this bill does is allow MFIP participants to earn GED and or a Minnesota adult diploma as an improved work activity. It allows MFIP participants to be enrolled in four-year post-secondary education programs and requires the department to inform every MFIP participant with a GED or diploma about their right to enroll in post-secondary education as an approved work activity. This gives new graduates the flexibility to job search for 12 weeks rather than 6 weeks, and finally removes barriers to English second language classes for workers who are learning English.
Would you move the bill first?
Yes, I move that House File 2458 be moved.
Just move it before the committee.
Move it, okay, be included in the omnibus for consideration. Thank you.
Catherine Wagoner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Catherine Wagoner. Many of you have heard my testimony already, so I'll just do a couple points. MFIP case managers are under enormous pressure to steer people away from education, and they're usually told that they have to go to a low-paying, low-skilled job. I want to make sure people understand that welfare to work is kind of a misnomer. People who are using the program are already workers. It's not like you can sit at home on welfare and do nothing. People are working. And this bill really helps. We keep hearing about the skills gap. And we have this pool of workers who could actually fill those jobs and do the work, except they're in a workforce program that really limits their availability or limits their opportunities to go to any of the trainings to fill that skills gap. So I'll stop there.
Any questions? Loeffler, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't always get dynamic fiscal notes, but I do think this is one of the investments where if we could help people get into, you know, living wage jobs that would assist their families, I think we'd see this impact on, you know, child care subsidies, housing subsidies, other demands that, that come before us. And I hope that, you know, that we can help people get to a better place of stability through their work, through training for jobs that pay.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, members, address Representative Loeffler's comments. If there's not funding in the the target, then this we have a MFIB or a TANF study looking at the allocation of TANF funds. This would be something that where TANF funds for federal and funds could be allocated for this. So that's one possibility.
Any other questions? Then the House File 2458 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And next we have 2599, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is pretty easy to explain. It just moves up the effective date for an increase in the housing assistance grant, and it's contingent, of course, upon availability of federal TANF funds, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or in Minnesota we call that program Minnesota Family Investment Program, and so it's sometimes confusing to people who might be watching, but they're the same program. This would be... would allow us to provide for family stability. We know that the cost of shelter beds is over $3,000 a month, and that this is a more cost-effective way to bring stability to those families. Demand for shelter has been higher than ever, and families are struggling with high heating bills and other issues, this particularly after this tough winter. And with that, I'll let the testifier speak.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Anderson.
Could I just interrupt the Representative Loeffler? You need to move with the bill first.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I would move for consideration House File 2599 to bring it before the committee. Sorry. We're all trying to move fast because we know time is of the essence.
Mr. Anderson.
All right. My comments are brief. My name is Jessica Anderson. I'm the Legislative Associate for the Children's Defense Fund here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of this bill, and thank you to Representative Loeffler for continuing her work to improve the lives of children and families. The Children's Defense Fund is a nonprofit child advocacy organization. Our mission is to ensure that every child has a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, and a moral start in life. We champion programs and policies that strengthen the financial stability of families and improve child well-being, and we believe that this bill would do both. CDF strongly supports efforts to provide housing assistance to fragile families as quickly as possible by moving up the implementation date of the housing assistance grant. A year is a significant amount of time in the life of a family living in poverty and certainly in the life of a young child. The cash grant for a family of three, as you probably know, is $531 per month. It hasn't been increased since 1986, but families need to use this to pay for their housing. Once implemented, the housing assistance grant will help these families fill the gap between what their cash grant is able to provide currently and the cost of housing, but the help is needed now. This grant has the potential to increase a family's economic security, which, as you know, improves child outcomes, and increase a family's ability to afford and retain safe housing. Safe and stable housing is critical to healthy child development. Working to ensure that children and families are more economically secure and stably housed as soon as possible, with the help of this grant, would have a significant impact on child growth and development, and we ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Questions? So next is Deb Konechny. Konechny. Yep.
My name is Lyndon Galboy. Deb Konechny couldn't be here, so I'm going to do the Welfare Rights Committee testimony. That's who I'm speaking for today. We want to thank you for this opportunity to testify. Right now, we have a crisis situation in Minnesota affecting 70,000 children. This crisis is called extreme poverty. While poverty in itself is a crisis, in itself, poverty creates a danger for children's health. It denies children housing. It makes children go hungry. It severely affects a child's chance at education. It makes it very hard for parents to get a job. And it forces parents to make devastating choices between food or housing for their family. That's poverty. However, extreme poverty is a poverty where a family's income is 60 to 70% below the federal poverty level. This is where the current welfare grant in Minnesota forces 70,000 children to live in extreme poverty. As was mentioned, the last time the grants were increased in this state was 28 years ago, 1986. 7 out of 10 who receive welfare in Minnesota are kids, mostly young kids. They are our children. They are our future. In 1986, a family of two received $437 a month for welfare. That's one mother and one child. Today, that dollar amount is still $437. We're asking you to just imagine trying to support yourself and your child on $437 a month. If you don't have subsidized housing, which is the case for two-thirds of the families on welfare, you cannot afford housing. You cannot afford to pay for electricity or heat. You are constantly trying to find people to stay with. You are living in a room at a shelter. You're living in a car. That's if you're lucky enough to have a car. Imagine trying to find a job when you're constantly looking for shelter. You have no permanent address. If you are lucky to have a phone for prospective job calls, it's always being disconnected because you need that money for more vital needs. Imagine trying to keep your child in school, providing an environment for learning when you're constantly changing whose house you're doubled up in, or if you're living in a shelter, or if you're on the street. Imagine your child trying to concentrate on learning when he or she may never know where they're going to be staying that night or what will happen tomorrow. Imagine when your food stamps for the month run out, which they always do, and you're now spending hours a day finding, getting to, and waiting in line at food shelves, going to soup lines to make sure your child gets a decent meal, or also knowing that your child is only getting food at school and goes to bed hungry. Imagine having to face every single day the stress that your child is going through when your child has no guarantees of safety or security, no fun time with friends, no carefree childhood, because every day is filled with stress and uncertainty. As a parent, you want to do everything to protect your child. If a landlord offers to give you a reduced rent if you give him some special favors, you compromise yourself to give a roof to your child over his head. Believe me, we have heard repeated stories of landlords who will take advantage of women in poverty while they are trying to keep their kids alive. If you're in a domestic violence situation with an abusive partner, you stay there or you go back to it, because your life is about keeping your child in a home. And if you have to get beaten up to keep a roof over your kid's head, you do it. Statistics show that about 60% of the mothers who need to be on welfare come from abusive situations. Minnesota's extreme poverty welfare grants force women to go back to abusive situations. We've heard a lot about the need to improve the situation for women, both in this state and in this country, yet we've heard nothing about improving the situation for the poorest of the poor women and their children. We've been scapegoated, abused, and attacked through the years. It's a crime, and the state should be hanging its head in shame for the way we've treated poor women. This year, there's a surplus. While the deficit has been taken out on poor families, now we have a surplus, and all we hear about is more tax breaks. We think this is just terrible. So the bill before you, which we strongly support, does not come close to making up for 28 years of without a grant increase. It is only a beginning. A small increase for families who do not have subsidized housing was passed last year but was delayed until 2015. This bill would move this grant start up to this year. And considering that only 28% of the federal TANF block grant actually goes to families in need, and that all that money should be going to increase the grants. We think that this bill is critical to pass now and take effect in July. Sorry for the long testimony, but this bill did not go to policy, and we wanted to let you know why this bill is important.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is probably for the author, so I don't know if this is the right time or if there's more testifiers.
There's one more.
One more. And then you'll be next. So I don't see any other questions. Sue Phillips.
Arena.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the interim executive director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and president and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, strongly supports this bill. We believe that everyone, without exception, needs to have a safe, decent, affordable, and accessible place to call home. As people of faith, we believe that how you treat the least of these is how we treat our God. We are commanded by our faith to love others as we love ourselves and to treat others the way that we'd want to be treated in this same situation. As I testified last year before this committee and at the Senate also, the housing costs in Minnesota are higher than any of our MFIP grants. For a two-bedroom apartment, it's $836 per month throughout the state on an average. In the metro area, it's $920 per month. So what we have is a situation where we are putting people that we are trying to assist to move back into employment at risk constantly of becoming homeless or of being homeless. And instead of providing that additional assistance immediately, which this bill does help with some additional assistance, we're paying shelters $3,000 a month to shelter families. So, I mean, fiscally, it just does not make sense not to do this right away and to use some of our TANF dollars and to use our surplus dollars. And I agree with Representative Abler that we certainly do need to be talking with the governor and leadership about increasing resources for this committee. Research shows that poverty is the greatest predictor of poor school performance, poor health, and homelessness. We can save incredible resources in emergency responses and other services by investing resources more wisely to allow people to meet their own needs, by having people have the resources so they can pay for their housing and they can move on in life, get jobs, have their kids do well in school, stay stable, and not use expensive emergency services. Thank you.
Questions for testifier? Okay, then we'll go to, we have three people signed up here. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for the author, although it might also be if there's anyone from DHS here in the room. I'm looking at the fiscal note, and I'm a little puzzled because I understand that this is moving up the implementation from what originally passed, which was in 2015, to this July 1st of 2014. And as I'm reading through the assumptions piece here on the fiscal note, it seems to me that, let's see, under assumptions it says, it is not possible to complete the system's work required to change the effective date for this provision. No fiscal impact is included here because it is assumed that the MFIP housing payment provision cannot be implemented prior to July 1st of 2015. And so I'm a little confused in terms of, are we passing this when we know that the money's not going to be there to actually implement it? I'm trying to follow rationalize the bill with what this fiscal note is saying, making sure we're not passing false hope to some of these advocates that something's going to be done this July, that in fact there's going to be no money at DHS to actually make sure that the changes are implemented.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. We just recently have gotten the fiscal note, and quite honestly, there needs to be further discussions about that issue. And we have always in this committee struggled with sometimes it seems like the computer people control policy more than sometimes we do, which is not necessarily, I think, the order in which it ought to happen. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, we did change how we do our computer management at the state, so we have another agency involved called MINIT, Minnesota IT, which has responsibility across all the agencies in terms of computers. And so this is something where I intend to follow up on and better understand. We have, I think it is 18 manual workarounds that are not ideal. And so the priority, I think, has not always been ideal, but in terms of how to make this work. But I think we'll do some problem solving to move forward if we have the opportunity to free up some TANF money. I'll be honest, I will be surprised if we're able to get it as fast as July. But I think the discussions need to continue.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief follow-up, and thank you for that explanation, Representative Loeffler. I know when you get these last minute or, you know, right before you're presenting, it can be difficult to process all the factors. I guess just as a comment, you know, DHS has gone through and is continuing to process a lot of changes with the implementation of MNsure and everything, and I know a lot of money has been spent on IT infrastructure optimization, and I know I, for one, have been very frustrated with the amount of investment made and the lack of progress for the amount of investment that's made with MNsure and what DHS has been trying to do. And in the EBO comments, you know, it pretty much, it says DHS asserts that given constraints in their IT infrastructure as determined by their internal MINIT staff, essentially that's why they're not going to be able to do this. And at this point, and I encourage you to kind of push back on that and make sure, and I think we as a legislature make sure that the investments that are being made at DHS in order to upgrade this infrastructure and things that we were told MNsure were going to be taking care of and federal dollars that are coming down we're supposed to take care of, we're still a ways behind, and it's frustrating, and you know, good issues like this are going to pay the price because of that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, just a brief response. I share your frustration. I do think that, as you might know, we have several different antiquated systems, one of which is our eligibility system, which this would be part of. It is not part of the healthcare system. You know, you were referring to MNsure. This is a system that, as I understand it, is based on 1970s computer coding with a minor update in the 1990s, maybe because past generations of leaders around these tables have always put the people first and the computer system second. I'm not sure. But my understanding is that they also have a hard time finding staff who actually have even been trained or are aware of the computer platforms that this is built on because they're decades out of date. And so I know there are challenges even if we give them money to find the people who they can hire to do this work. But that's no excuse for saying policy should be determined by the difficulty of doing some computer coding.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a quick comment to just really all the authors from Representative Newton to Allen to Loeffler and to Patty to Representative Fritz for the pieces of legislation that you're bringing to this committee today. You know, it only reminds me of the Legislative Commission to end poverty by 2020. And we have not done much. They gave us some recommendation to lift people up out of poverty. And I think all of these bills are in reference to how we can do that. It is a huge investment, but we must create better opportunity for people to help themselves. And the bills that have all been set before us is doing exactly that. I remember coming here in 2010, and I remember the gloom and doom that I felt as programs after programs, as the nursing home disabled will cut. You know, that's not easily forgotten. And I am not sure of forgetting how I felt in every committee as program after program after program were cut. We have to invest. If we're going to follow the recommendation that came from the Legislative Commission to end poverty by 2020, we're on a good path. Just want to say thank you all.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just an observation also. You know, I'm moved by the need of these people. I, you know, in my own life, I've served 13 years at jail ministry, no pay, just volunteer, try to help people. I tried to help many of the prisoners once they got out in their situation, okay? So, amongst other things, and I'm not trying to toot my horn, but I'm just trying to share with you that I have a concern for people in need. The question is, how do we best do that? And one of the things I realized is both, whether you're on our side of the aisle or the other side, we both want more tax revenues, okay? So the question is, how do we generate enough tax revenues to meet the needs of the people that truly need the help, okay? And I think the way to do that is to have a reasonable tax and regulatory system. And what I mean by that is, if we look to the Northwest, North Dakota, we see a state with reasonable permitting, reasonable taxes, and reasonable regulations that are generating huge surpluses, okay, in the in their state. They don't have to pass a minimum wage bill because Walmart, the last I read, is paying between $15 and $18 an hour to get an employee to work at them. So my point is, the other thing we're a blessed state in mineral resources. According to the University of Minnesota, we have probably more than $2 trillion of minerals in northern Minnesota that could generate billions of tax dollars.
Mr. Representative Gruenhagen, would you...
Okay, I'll wrap
address,
up.
Address the bill we have before us.
All right. I'm trying to get the money for it. But anyway, I'll wrap up. The point is that unfortunately in our state, with punitive regulations and taxes and difficulty getting permits, and in my own district, a company that once employed 3,000 people, private company, has now moved the majority of its operations outside the state of Minnesota, where if they were in Minnesota, they could be generating millions of dollars of tax revenue for the state. So the way to get to the point where we have the money to meet the needs is what John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan believed, and that is to reduce taxes and regulations and make them reasonable, and you'll have the money to meet those needs. Thank you for your forbearance, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Thanks.
You have one more bill to go.
I know, and actually it's to both bills. I was just looking at the fiscal note, and so neither cost money, but I think this one costs money because they can't do it. Is that what the fiscal note says?
The next two bills, or this bill and the next one, the Department of Human Services said they cannot implement the date change that we're putting.
Right. That's why it's free. Okay. Thank you. The difficult takes a while, Mr. Chair. The impossible takes longer. So thank you. So I tackled the impossible.
Any final comments, Representative?
No, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the committee's time, and okay. With that, would.
Okay, then House File 2599 will be laid over.
Thank you.
And next we have House File 2678, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Everybody,
welcome to the committee. You want to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 2678.
Okay, that's been so moved. Representative Fritz.
Come sit down. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I know it's late, so I'll just go. What we're trying to, first of all, I want to thank the committee and the members for actually putting into law the removing the family cap for the MFIP population that we did do in the last year, and that had the support of many folks and the Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life and worked closely with us on this as well. We had everybody here at the table, the welfare rights, the Catholics, the Lutherans, all of us together. So doing good work, doing very good work, and we were able to do that because we're saving our children's, our babies, and are saving our children's lives, and that's what this bill does by removing that cap. So what I'd like to do, though, is move it up to July 1st, to implement it this July 1st. And I do have a couple of testifiers, and then I can just respond to any questions.
Would you like to go?
If I could.
Hi, yep. My name is my name is Angel Buchner, and I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 2678, the bill that removes the so-called family cap starting now. As you may have heard from other testifiers, the family cap is so that the cash MFIP grant does not increase if an additional child is born into the family when it passed into law. It did so by catering to nasty myths and stereotypes about families on MFIP. Babies happen, and there are also many reasons why babies don't unhappen: moral, religious, financial, and political. But everyone, especially the parents, knows that raising babies costs more than $87 per month. We feel that this law serves to punish babies for being born, and its repeal is long, long overdue. We are glad it was overturned last year, but we are also disappointed that it is not scheduled to go into effect until 2015. So please consider putting this provision into the omnibus bill today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
One or another.
Thank you. Who's next? Jessica Anderson.
Hi, good morning again. My name is Jessica Anderson with the Children's Defense Fund. Thank you to Representative Fritz for bringing this bill forward, and thank you for being allowed to testify today in support of this bill. CDF supports moving up the implementation date of the Family Cap repeal by 6 months. Again, like with the housing assistance grant, we believe that a month even is a significant amount of time in the life of a child. Generally, the MFIP grant is based on family size. However, as you know, no adjustment is made for the additional costs of a newborn if the family was receiving MFIP assistance at the time of the baby's conception. This lack of funds further financially strains the approximately one out of every seven families receiving MFIP assistance with a newborn. The current MFIP grant leaves a family of three at 62% of the federal poverty guidelines. If an additional child is born, their income is reduced to 51% of poverty as a result of the family cap. This is deep poverty, and it's highly correlated with poor childhood and adulthood outcomes. CDF believes that implementing the repeal of the family cap as soon as possible is important for two main reasons. First, the family cap pushes families deeper into poverty, and at a time when families are under a great deal of stress, not just the stress associated with poverty, of course, but the stresses of having a new baby. Second, the deep poverty that results from failing to account for the newborn child is harmful to the child and his or her siblings, especially if those siblings are very young. It is not solely poverty or the degree of poverty that matters for child outcomes, but when, during childhood, the poverty occurs. Poverty early in a child's life is especially harmful for outcomes related to achievement, skills, and cognitive development. This committee knows very well the critical importance of early childhood in brain development and for establishing the neural functions and structures that shape future cognitive, social, emotional, and health outcomes. From the little data we have on the 70,000 children receiving MFIP assistance each month, including the 35,000 children who are under the age of 6, we know that they are not doing well. In fact, 61% of children ages 3 months to 5 years screened as part of a pilot project scored positive for possible cognitive, emotional, or behavioral delays. Increasing the incomes of families living in deep poverty by implementing the repeal of this family cap as soon as possible would have a positive impact on child development. Repealing the family cap and thereby recognizing the additional costs associated with raising an additional child could result in almost $1,000 per year for a child and his or her family. That amount is not insignificant. In fact, a 2011 study by the Brookings Institution found that an additional $1,000 of average annual family income throughout early childhood results in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. Moving up the date of the repeal would have a positive developmental impact on thousands of Minnesota children, and as a result, a positive and long-lasting effect on our community. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, but thank you to the testifier, too, for a very compelling testimony. I guess just as a note, I assume you know your fiscal note is kind of similar to what Representative Loeffler said about the issues at DHS being able to implement this or move up the implementation date. And so I guess I'm just wondering, you know, is there an option where it's effectively repealed as far as the legislature sees it? DHS isn't able to change all of the technical pieces. So if there's mistakes between July 1st and January 1st, are there ways to work around the problems that we're having at DHS? Because obviously if technology's not ready, it's not ready, and I don't know how we as a legislature force that. But is there a way that we can work around that for things like this? And this would also be the Loeffler's bill. where, you know, for the compelling reasons the testifier gave, obviously this should be a priority as soon as possible to help these families and the kids. And so I'm just wondering, in light of the fiscal note, what are the options?
Well, thank you for your question. Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, thank you very much for your question, and that's going through my head as well. And part of the reason to bring this, to move it up, and I've had success with one bill before moving a date up, and so I'm somewhat persistent about finding a way that we could do this because of the importance. And when we start saying extreme poverty for 70,000 in the state of Minnesota, that's extremely alarming to me and should be to all of us and to the department as well. And I'm new to the technology world, but I do text and that sort of thing. however, I can't, we do, and since I've been here for 10 years too, I was at the beginning, as Representative Moran talked about, I was really disturbed that we're so behind in our technology in Minnesota. So I'm hoping that we can look, I'm willing to look at anything and everything to get this done.
And Mr. Chair, just briefly, thank you, Representative Fritz. And I, too, have gone through a lot of what Representative Loeffler said, understand the archaic system that the counties have been working with in the department and the effort to do that. I know it's been communicated to me as part of the justification and, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, the 90% match that was going to be coming down from the feds to lift all of our IT up and out of the doldrums of the 1970s, not just our healthcare systems, but all of our eligibility programs. And so I know I'll be inquiring of Commissioner Jessen, where are we at? What is the problem? Why are we so far behind? I know it, I don't mean to simplify updating technology. I know it's no easy thing, but we also have a lot of people making a lot of money for the sole job of doing this to make sure that we can deliver our programs to Minnesotans. And so if I can be of assistance at all, but I'll be asking Commissioner Jessen personally and hope maybe with collaborated efforts we can get some answers to those questions. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, is this TANF eligible, this expenditure? So there's that $9 million at the end of the second biennium. So if that was one of your choices, you could do that. And just I wanted to, since there's no time left to debate this, do you know why that DHS can't do reprogramming? They sent 30 people over to work on pencil and paper at Minsure. So I think they can't change. Their VCR is still flashing 12 o'clock over there, Mr. Chair. So, but maybe there's a way to help them with that bit. So I'm just, if this is that easy, maybe there's somewhere to go. I think a lot of us like this proposal, and it's cheap enough.
Sue Phillips.
Yes.
Still here?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Sue Watlow Phillips, Interim Executive Director of MICA and President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. I'm not going to go over my previous testimony, but briefly to say that MICA and Integrated Community Solutions have supported this repeal since it was instated and have worked against cuts to our public assistance grants for the last 30 years that I've been here working at the Capitol. And just to be very clear, as a conservative woman, and as my choice is being pro-life means conception to death, not just conception to birth. And the children of MFIP are God's creation, and they are potential future legislators, business leaders, and employees. The families need these resources right now so they can be in housing. We're going to spend these resources one way or another. If it means in shelter and with kids doing poorly in school, and we're going to pay for that long term, we're going to pay for this one way or another. So we need to do this now, and that we need children to become all that God created them to be. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? So thank you for your testimony. Is there someone else in the audience that wishes to testify?
Good
Welcome
morning,
Ms. Committee. Would you state your name for the record?
My name is Carrie Sheldon. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm speaking on behalf of one of the members in our Welfare Rights Committee who couldn't be here today. Today, things have truly changed since the Welfare Reform Bill passed in 1996. Now there is a family cap on MFIP, which has not been raised since 1986. The cost of living has increased for many, 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 many times since 1986, but the MFIP grant has remained the same at $437 for mom, dad, and one child. The very same as if it has been since 1986. This is unacceptable and must be changed as soon as possible. We, the Welfare Rights Committee, want the MFIP grants to be raised this year. 2015 is way too long.
Yeah,
if the MFIP grants get raised, the poor will be able to pay more of their own rent, buy more food, and the poor would not be as dependent on TANF funding. The family cap must be removed to allow families a longer grace period in case the job market is in a complicated or slow slump. I believe that the head of these families' households will find work faster with the MFIP safety net in place longer. This is why we, the Welfare Rights Committee, want the family cap removed. We here at the grassroots level have seen these MFIP families really have a bad life when funding runs out. When funding runs out before the head of the household finds a job to support the rest of the family. I believe that if the family cap is removed, these parents will be able to go to school as well to help their families up and out of poverty.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I don't see any. So, Representative Fritz, do you have any final comments?
Well, I think we've heard very good testimony. I think the testifiers have made the case. Thank you.
So, House File 2678 will be laid over. Thank you, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, members, Mr. Chair.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.